Health and Safety Authority has released its annual report for 2020, which showed that despite the fact that much of the country was in various forms of restrictions throughout the vast majority of that year, the number of workplace-related deaths rose by 13% to 53 in all. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Sharon McGuinness, Chief Executive of the Health and Safety Authority. Sharon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
It's particularly, I mean, any workplace-related fatality is a matter of concern, but the increase last year is concerning in and of itself, but particularly in the context of COVID-19 restrictions.
As you said, any fatality is a very sad event, and it's certainly an event that the family and of the loved ones or of those victims find particularly challenging and, of course, are still living through it. So I think when we see last year, we had 53 work-related fatalities, and of those, I suppose, when you look at the figures, you see that 28 of those were people who were self-employed, and there was 12 people who were employees. And then, tragically, there were also 13 people who were non-workers. And of those 13, very sadly, 5 of those were children under the age of 18. So, you know, it was a very kind of, I suppose, sobering picture for last year. But in some ways, it brings home the fact that for certain sectors, you know, fatalities may occur. And it's really important that we do everything in our ability to prevent it, which is why we give so much advice and support out there to employers, self-employed and others in the workplace to keep themselves safe.
The sectors linked to the majority of workplace-related fatalities, Sharon, agriculture, forestry and fishing, and long has that been the case?
That has been, I suppose, you know, it is a sector that we do see continued high numbers of fatalities over the years. Obviously, we are working and we have been working very closely with that sector, and I know the sector are very minded of these high numbers of not just fatalities but also serious incidents, and are working very hard to bring that down. I suppose when you look at the sector itself, you have to look at, you know, the way it works. So we see a lot of, even in the figures we announced today, an awful lot of the fatalities are seen in people over the age of 65. And that, again, is a number, the type of person that you see on farms, perhaps still working because they, you know, they're physically feel that they can and they wish to, but equally, as well, they're also self-employed. So they're often working on their own and being everything on the farm, from the farmer to the construction worker to the, you know, to everything in between. And yet we're asking them, you know, to be their own health and safety manager and mind themselves. In order to mind, you know, stay safe and continue to work, but equally also not to cause any harm to any visitor on the farm, particularly a loved one or a family member.
The 13 non-worker fatalities, including very tragically 5 children, Sharon, in what sectors did they occur?
They occurred in culture with Baron and otherwise and others. They're the primary ones where we would have seen it. So as I said, again, it's that idea to remind people that you see when people come onto the workplace, be they, you know, customers, clients or visitors, and it's really important. It is a workplace and whoever's in charge as the employer or the self-employed person, they're responsible for keeping them safe. So that's why, as I said, we have a huge amount of advice out there for not only the individual worker, but equally the employer and the self-employed person to set up their systems in advance so that they can prevent these kind of incidents. But equally, you know, they can do the risk assessment. They can also do a lot of learning courses. And one of the things you'll have seen in the release today is that we had seen a lot of uptake on not only, you know, our B-Smart, which is our risk assessment tool, which is free, that people can do their own safety statements and risk assessments. But equally, we saw a 60% increase in people taking up courses. So in some ways, it was while we noted the earlier figures on the numbers of fatalities, it was a positive year in the sense that people perhaps took the time and became more aware of health and safety in general and took the time to learn more and to put I suppose, the right systems in place to keep everybody safe.
And you would hope, Sharon, that awareness will trickle through to figures and data and lives saved in years to come.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the, you know, the principal drivers for the authority is always the prevention of these incidents. We don't want to see fatalities. We don't want to see injuries. And what we do is spend an awful lot of time putting the advice and supports out there, working with the individuals, workers or sectors to make sure that they know how to keep themselves safe in that regard. So I mentioned a few of the different, I suppose, free tools we have. We also have a workplace contact unit where people can come to us for a lot of advice. And again, last year we saw almost a 30-40% increase in calls to us. And the majority of them are always looking for advice and information in the first instance. So, you know, we're more than happy to work with people. And as I said, but keeping the mind and everybody keeping in mind that health and safety isn't a once-off.
Mm.
You must remember it. And that's why we often say, you know, I've said to, you know, a farmer going out in the morning or somebody going out, you know, to do a construction job, when you put on your boots or you put on your hat, think yourself first. Are you safe? Have you thought about it? Have you planned that work? Is your machine, you know, well maintained? That's the kind of thing we want to get people to start thinking about, so that when they do go out and do the job, it's done safely and they can get home at night.
There was a 21% across the board reduction in every sector of the economy in non-fatal incidents and accidents reported to you last year. There were still 7,500 people, or just shy of that, who sustained an injury in the workplace. But 21% is a very significant reduction. Would you attribute that, Sharon, to awareness, to better protocols in place in workplaces, or COVID restrictions?
I suppose looking at it just as a figure for 1 year, it's hard to make any I suppose detailed analysis on it. But in essence, you would probably presume, based on historical facts and evidence that we have before, you know, many of those particular sectors that would normally report may not have been fully active, or where, for example, we're operating. You know, someone might have been closed at a particular time for a particular period. Some might have been operating but not have everybody there either. Some people might have been working from home. So we probably would have seen, I think, those figures reflecting the COVID reality of how the majority of workplaces and work was happening in the course of 2020.
Well, Dr. Sharon McGuinness, Chief Executive of the Health and Safety Authority, thank you indeed for joining us. This week is a really, really important week in the life of the Women's Integrated Network in Athy. It is celebrating 15 years of celebrating diversity in Athy. And I'm joined on the line by one of the driving forces in that organisation. It's Deputy Chief Coordinator Frances Sonny Ituan. Frances, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Kira. It's good to be here.
We're delighted to have you. This is such a huge week for WIN, and for people that may not be familiar with its origins, with its ethos, with how it's evolved over the last decade and a half. Can you take us back through that?
Oh, Kira, thank you so much. It's really amazing. I was saying to myself a few minutes ago, where did the time go? You know, I remember going back 14, 15 years back, and I had run into a few friends of mine, and not too friendly people as well. And they were like, what's happening? What's this? And I'm like, can I give you a lift? I said, sure, I'm just your neighbor. And then, you know, the guy is thinking about, what's this about? I said, well, I have some forms. You want to fill them out for me? You want to tell me how you feel? And that began our journey, you know, gathering information and kind of needs analysis to know what the issues were around integration. And it has blossomed, I must tell you, because that my friend that I met that day that wasn't so friendly, he's been my lifelong friend to this day. In fact, last week he said to me, I cannot believe how time flew. You know, and that's the most amazing part of it all, you know. The Women's Integrated Network, what we actually strive to do is to empower women for positive integration.
Yeah.
And we do that through information, through training, skills, knowledge acquisition, potential development, and social networking. We do a lot of networking because we have found that we're able to achieve more. You know, bearing in mind that we have very little or no funding, you know. So whatever funds that we lay our hands on, we do as much as we can to stretch it and stretch it until it's actually it's an elastic limit. But I must say to you, you know, in the same vein, like Kildare County Council, the festival grants, they have been amazing in supporting celebrating diversity from the very beginning. You know, and it's amazing. I was speaking to one of the colleagues there, and I said, I was asking, what about Alice? Because that was the very first lady in the Kildare Festival Grant section
yeah.
that attended to us. She didn't know us. She didn't know what we were for whether we're going to stay or not stay, but she entrusted us by supporting us in the very first Celebrating Diversity. It's been just amazing ever since then.
I'm always struck, Frances, by just how much Wynn has evolved in its relatively short time. So you started off wanting to celebrate diversity and create a space for integration. But yeah. Now you're political and civil partnership, labour activation, skills yeah. and knowledge acquisition. I mean, this is a hugely quick evolution.
It really is. And one of the things, one of the successes that we've had to date is we have had people who were genuinely interested in progressing issues that were identified or raised at workshops, at seminars. And that has consistently blown my mind. So I keep saying to myself, perhaps I should be used to what I hear now or what happens now. But no, there is no getting used to it because it's just very dynamic. It's dynamic, to the extent that sometimes you're saying to yourself, pinch yourself to be sure you're not sleeping or dreaming. You know, like... I remember one of the exchanges that we had in Israel, Haifa, Israel, in 2010. And that was the very first time, the issues around labor market mobility, came up. And then some of the throwbacks was, well, you can't really say somebody is integrating well, positive into the society or a community if they cannot economically look after themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wait a minute, that is a point that is really huge. And, and then we found even kind of further research that amongst our members and the people who had used our services, that domestic violence is directly proportional to the dependence of the spouse, on her spouse. So, for example, if you are a lady who is married and you don't have a paying job, and your husband has a paying job, if he is an abusive partner, then the rate of violence, domestic violence you will experience will be proportional to the amount of money that you need, or amount of financial support that you need from himself. So it kind of buttresses, the labor market mobility issue, around economic empowerment, And we found too that you cannot talk about economic empowerment really if you do not participate in the politics and in the civic society.
Mm.
Therefore, we said to ourselves, how can we encourage people who are new to the community, new to the environment, who may have had their voting in other counties? How can we get them to transfer it to County Kildare so that they can actually physically participate in the electoral process? And then, that sparked our work then. It was then called KCP, and they funded some of the workshops that we had around voter awareness,
And Frances, just to mark your 15th anniversary and the 14th anniversary of the public launch, you have really a festival of events that are taking place this Thursday. Can you talk us through them?
Yes, Kira. It's been amazing, really. Roller coaster this year has been on anything but usual. And at the last minute, we have planned, taking into consideration government guidelines, we're going to have in person, in the art, and then online. But at the last minute, after the announcement last Monday, we had to change it back now to online.
Yeah.
And then participants' gardens. So we have spoken to some of the participants who will be staging some different activities, different shows. They're working from their gardens, so that we'll be able to connect it and show it to the whole world. So those who are participating from outside, those who can't physically be present because of the government guidelines and restrictions, are still able to participate. And I tell you one secret. Somebody said to me, what happens to the food that we always get? I said, don't worry, you're going to have the food.
Somebody has their priorities right.
I'm telling you. We have the caterer on standby, to deliver to homes, in around the area. So what we have said to people, text us back with your choice when you receive the menu. Text us your choice so that the caterer can take it on board and deliver to you at the right time. Because we're trying as much as we can to work within the confines of the decisions that we have.
Well, I would imagine there are very, very few events, celebratory or otherwise, Francis, that are delivering food to people, the homes of participants. So you might be alone in that, which is wonderful.
I think one of the brainstorming sessions, and I said, well, so would we do this? Because in truth, really, some of the people who attend our events actually look forward to that hot meal.
Yeah.
But that is the meal that they get, you know, good meal that they get, especially those of them who are in homeless accommodations, and those who are experiencing domestic violence and have been moving from one place to the other for safety reasons. So I was really, you know, surprised when they said, we can get them to deliver to the respective, and I'm like, well, we can try that, you know, and see how it goes. And especially because in the past 16 months, we've been delivering food to people during the pandemic. So that perhaps is the experience upon which this pilot will be happening. So we hope to see what happens at the end of the day, you know, what the feedback is.
And everybody can find out more information about how to access all of the events on Thursday through the Women's Integrated Network -win-athai.org. Francis Sony Ichuan, Deputy Chief Coordinator of the Women's Integrated Network Athai, thank you indeed for joining us. A feast of events there, and a feast literally available for Win Athai's 15th anniversary celebrations this Thursday. Now, the new Garda Powers Bill was unveiled a couple of weeks ago, and among its potential provisions is that a person who refuses to surrender a password or mobile phone or other device to Gardaí will be committing a crime and could face up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to €30,000. The bill has not yet made its way through the Houses of the Oireachtas, but Kildare Focus producer Kieran Noble has been speaking to Dr. Cian O'Cruachúr, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at the Department of Law at Maynooth University, to get his considered opinion.
So the new Garda Powers Bill that the Minister for Justice just put before the Oireachtas a couple of weeks ago now, it's really an omnibus kind of rationalisation of existing Garda powers. So the idea is lots of Garda powers, you know, arrest powers, detention powers, powers to question you, they're kind of spread across a lot of different pieces of legislation. And one of the main aims of the new law is to kind of bring everything together for you as a citizen, and you know, lawyers and judges, they can just look to one piece of legislation and identify specifically where the particular power might reside. So that's a good thing, and that's part of a recommendation by the Law Reform Commission a couple of years ago and the Commission on the Future Policing. They've recommended some of these, like a lot of the changes that are coming in the 2021 bill are following on from the recommendations of those two bodies. Now, where...
Yeah, I was just about to say, Cian, there are some controversies in regards to the bill.
Yeah,
in
so there particular are some significant controversies. There are some concerns about whether this is going to expand Garda powers of search. People like TJ McIntyre in University College Dublin have written about that. There is also a lot of concern, a lot of talk around there's going to be a new Garda power where... so. As it stands, there are certain circumstances where if the Gardaí are conducting a search and they come across your electronic device, so you know your iPad or your iPhone or your computer, in certain circumstances now they can ask you for your password to get access to the information on that when they're conducting a search warrant. And the plan is under the new law is to say, right, for any search warrant, when the Gardaí are using or operating under any district court granted search warrant, then they can turn to you if they pick up your iPhone or your computer, and they can say, give me the password for that. And if you refuse to do that, you might be committing a criminal offence. That's a very significant expansion, and it's very, very controversial. And it's relevant to the kind of thing that I'm going to talk about, what I'm more interested around the area of journalistic privilege, that particular expansion.
Yeah,
which is problematic.
Yeah, this is obviously very important to us here. So, I guess the questions that you have is how Irish law will protect journalists' rights and confidentiality in particular. People may have heard of journalistic privilege. They may have heard of off the record, you know, whistleblowers. They're all very important to getting stories out there that affect the whole world at times. And obviously, if the guards can have access to these electronic devices where you'll have this information, that means that those people are not going to feel as confident to divulge the secrets or the stories they have if they think their name can get out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two problems with the bit of the proposed legislation with regards to journalists' rights. So, I mean, the main one I'll talk about in a minute, but obviously if there is a search and a journalist is being searched and they're compelled to hand over their phone and the Garda can immediately start checking, while they're conducting the search, a Garda can look through your phone as a journalist and identify potential sources. That compromises significantly your ability to do future work as journalists, because maybe sources in the future might feel like they can't come forward to you in confidence and disclose sensitive information if other people like the Gardaí, particularly state actors. If we're talking about state whistleblowers here, the Gardaí having access to your information might be very, very worrying for you. But the bigger problem, as I see it, with the proposed legislation, it's not just a problem with the new law, it's a problem with the current law, which is journalistic privilege, if you want to call it that. So there are legal protections under our constitution and under the European Court of Human Rights, specifically for journalists and other publishers, to be allowed to protect the confidentiality of confidential sources. So people who come forward to you, like whistleblowers, to you as a journalist, someone comes forward to you in confidence and says, look, I have some really relevant, important public interest information, but I'm only willing to give it to you if you don't name me, because, that could jeopardize my career or could put me and my family at risk, different types of risk. There are lots of circumstances where people will only come forward, as you know, as a journalist, they'll only come forward to you if it's off record, and they may have very good reasons for that. And this jurisdiction have until from about 2009 said, yes, you as a journalist, you have a special interest in protecting that. Now, so journalists call it journalistic privilege, but it's not. So the courts don't call it that, because privilege has a very particular meaning in our legal system. So you do have a certain right of confidentiality. And the problem with the current law is that it doesn't protect, the current warrant granting. So this is where the Gardaí are going into the district court looking for a warrant to search a journalist's premises. The warrant granting court, the district court, they can't take into consideration your rights as a journalist, that you might have a right of confidentiality. And the current law has that problem, and the proposed law doesn't fix it.
Keen, I just want to note the tension between judges and journalists about what the journalistic privilege is, because, as you note, it's perceived differently by journalists. They do, in general, think it's absolute, but it's not. How will the new Garda Powers Bill help with that tension?
It won't help with that tension at all. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a very interesting. I'm doing a bit of research on this at the moment. Is specifically that area of tension between. So the journalists, you have a particular vision. You think there's no circumstances in which I should be compelled to hand over information that might identify my confidential sources. And that's why you claim privilege. The courts have said no. Ultimately, the courts can decide if in certain circumstances they feel it's necessary. They can say, well, we can compel you as journalists. Now, that's resulted in situations in other countries, where journalists have had to go to prison to protect their sources on contempt of court, but that's where the tension arises. Now, the new law doesn't address any of that. I mean, actually, it causes a problem. The reason it may be unconstitutional, and I think the current law is unconstitutional, because the courts have been very strong in emphasizing to journalists to say, look, this is a decision we make as judges. We decide whether or not you have confidentiality protection over your sources. And the law doesn't allow the courts to do that. And I think that's why it might be constitutionally problematic.
Keane, what changes would you like to see to the new bill?
So there are other systems in place in neighbouring jurisdictions. So if you look at Northern Ireland, and people might be familiar with the Loughlin Island murder, the sectarian murders, there was a documentary on that called No Stone Unturned that was controversial, and there was a police investigation into how they got that documentary, got access to certain police files from the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And in that case, when it came to court, the journalists challenged the fact that they were searched. They focused in on a particular procedure, and that basically said the court that gives the police, and in Ireland, I guess that would be the Gardaí, the court that gives the police their warrant to search a journalist's premises, they have to take into account journalists' rights. And I think it'd be very easy for the proposed law to bring in a procedure like that, where the district court would have to take into consideration that journalists have very strong rights in this area.
Well, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at the Department of Law at NUI Maynooth, Dr. Keane O'Crahore, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks very much, Ciara.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, Ireland is experiencing its first She Session. New research by Rethink Ireland in partnership with the National Women's Council of Ireland has found lockdown has had a significant impact on women's jobs, incomes and household responsibilities. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Orla O'Connor, Director of the National Women's Council of Ireland. Orla, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Now, I imagine that the people in Ireland who have not been affected economically or otherwise by lockdown are very few and far between. How is this research showing us that the effect on women is disproportionate?
Well, the research is doing two things. I mean, Rethink Ireland has funded a number of projects to support women into employment. So it's all about economic equality. And this initially started before the pandemic, and what was shown as the work that was being done by different projects supporting women into the workplace was really the impact that COVID has had. And I mean, there's been global research as well as now this research in Ireland. I mean, what we've seen is that, you know, the sectors in the country who are employing high numbers of women have been really badly affected, such as in, you know, leisure, hospitality. Also, the whole impact of care, and whether that's been about homeschooling, you know, clearly when childcare was closed, it's also about care not being available in the way that it would have been, for example, through grandparents supporting care. So what COVID has really done is, while it hasn't created those inequalities, it really has shone a light on the inequalities that were there for women that have become, that became really much more heightened as a result of COVID. And also, I think another aspect that the projects really showed up was the gender divide in digital literacy and access to technology. So for example, what, you know, the projects were working with more disadvantaged women, and it really showed that they were at an increased disadvantage in terms of that, you know, being able to access and participate, particularly because of that digital literacy space that they're not necessarily in. And for so many businesses as well who have moved online, it was showing that it was harder, particularly for more marginalised women, to be able to participate. So it showed a number of things, and these things again are borne out by research in Europe and globally. And I think one of the important things about the report, it is saying that, you know, we're in a critical time right now, as we're in a sort of a COVID recovery period. And we really need to take these things on board in terms of issues like care, in terms of where women who are more marginalised, be it traveller women, be it lone, you know, women parenting alone, that they need increased support in this period of recovery.
I think certainly for anybody with a child who was of an age requiring care outside the home, the lockdown has created enormous difficulties. But if you require care outside the home, you're parenting alone and you need that care in order to go to work, it's devastating.
Absolutely. And we saw that sort of, you know, in two ways. One, for women and for women who are parenting alone and were in jobs and trying to, you know, continue to do that work, as well as having all the care responsibilities there as well. And for some women, that just became absolutely impossible. We know that there's, you know, been more of an increase of women not returning, for example, after maternity leave. And also then for women who were looking for work and it just became impossible to do in the current circumstances, because work that ordinarily might have been available in terms of more part-time work just wasn't there because of the pandemic. So there were two different things going on for low-income parent families. And also there was a huge increased pressure on those parenting loan. And we've seen that as well in terms of some of the work that the Women's Council has done around mental health, because the issue of care really came up, you know, very strong in that as being a cause for women citing how they felt that there was real a negative impact on their mental health during the pandemic.
The digital literacy piece, I think that this is the first time that research has come into the public domain on this, and the disparity in digital literacy and its impact on women who may be marginalised versus their male counterparts. What are the net effects of this, Orla?
Yeah, I mean, that came up in particular for the projects, for example, working with, you know, traveller women, working with women in rural areas, that was harder. It was harder in terms of both, you know, being able to participate in things online as everything went online, and then also in terms of both trying to apply for jobs and not having those digital literacy skills. So it really, I think, points to the whole issue, and I know this is one of the issues that the government are really looking at in the next budget, but it's the whole issue about training and upskilling. Mm. Is, you know, what needs to be put in place so that those who are sort of furthest removed from that are being reached out to in terms of training that's being provided.
I know that training, upskilling, reskilling is one of the key recommendations of the report. Can you flesh that out a little for us?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a number of recommendations in the report, and I think they start with the issue of care and needing to have public childcare, but also public, so you know, public universal care services, mm. whether that's for women with disabilities, or also older people as well, and a new model of social care, because I think that's one of the things the pandemic really has highlighted is, you know, our model of and being in very large congregated settings and these sort of, you know, large nursing home settings, older people are clearly saying they want something very different, and it's about how you support independent living. So there's a series of recommendations in terms of care. And then in terms of the more work-related ones, which is about how we can reform our work model and our social welfare model that allows people to move in and out of work and to accommodate care responsibilities, but also to accommodate them, that doesn't mean ending up in part-time or low-paid precarious work. It has to be about decent jobs for people, and jobs also that enable progression routes, because what we are seeing is a cycle. Like every year the statistics come out in relation to poverty in Ireland, and we see that lone parents are one of the highest categories, mm. always at those at risk of poverty. So there's a cycle of being in, you know, low-paid work, you know, being in and out of low-paid work, and the systems are not there to support people out of those poverty traps. So we need to have a model of work that's about decent pay, and that means about paying people the living wage, but it also means about having public flexible childcare and then a social welfare system that allows people to move in and out and supports them to do that.
Orla O'Connor, Director of the National Women's Council, thank you indeed for joining us to share with us the findings and recommendations of that Rethinking Ireland study done in conjunction with the National Women's Council.